I'm Kirk Harnack. On This Week in Radio Tech, we're talking to John Poré. He's executive director of the Society of Broadcast Engineers. He's going to tell us what we already know. We're getting old. Where are the new engineers coming from? Hey, Chris Tarr and Tom Ray join me to figure this out on This Week in Radio Tech, up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is This Week in Radio Tech, episode 128, recorded May 9th, 2012. John Poré. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Omnia Audio and the popular Omnia AXE and Omnia FXE software processors for streaming on the web at omniaaudio.com. Hello, it's time for This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. Very glad that you have joined us. This is the show where we talk about radio technology. A bunch of engineers get together and talk about old-time radio, current radio, what's going to happen in the future. We talk to radio movers and shakers. We talk to engineers. Sometimes talk to programming people. Sometimes we just talk amongst ourselves and reminisce about the good old days and hope that maybe these are going to be the good old days. I've got some co-hosts on the show, so let's introduce them to you. First of all, I'm Kirk Harnack. I work for the folks at Telos, Omnia, and Axia, and they are also kind enough to sponsor this episode of This Week in Radio Tech. Let's take our moving map to the Hudson Valley of New York and talk to the director of engineering for Buckley Broadcasting. It's Tom Ray. Hello, Tom.
Hey, greetings, Kirk. How are you doing this evening?
Lovely. What's up with you?
I'm the guy who actually is, single-handedly and silently checking out and trying to disprove the theory that dinosaurs died from their own flatulence.
I saw you put on something on Facebook about that today.
Yes, I did. That was my status. Yeah. After I went over to NBC and plucked some peacock feathers.
All right. When you're not plucking peacock feathers, Tom, what are you doing in New York City?
I'm the VP of engineering of WOR Radio and Buckley Broadcasting. And actually, the reason I was at NBC today was we do a little deal with their weather people in the afternoon drive. And I was over there experimenting to see if we could get the Comrex access to run on their corporate LAN.
Ah, okay. And did you?
So it works going out. Won't work coming in because they're firewalled 25 ways to Sunday. So
it's always firewalled. You know, get a separate DSL drop and be done with it.
That's what I'm considering.
There's probably some Sarbanes-Oxley rule against doing that, though.
I think the rule is that for whatever reason, they won't be able to get a DSL line down to the third floor where the news studio is. So.
Oh well. All this technology, and we're stymied by the people who run the firewall. You know, sometime it seems like the broadcast engineers and the folks who do the firewall ought to really get together and try to come to an understanding. Don't you think?
Yeah, well, the baseball bat makes them understand in a real hurry. But anyway, Hey, don't forget, I'm in New York.
Let's check in with another panelist, a regular co-host on the show. That's Chris Tarr from Mukwonago, Wisconsin. Hello there, Chris. How are you?
Hello there. Cheers to first world problems, I suppose. I'm doing all right. I'm the director of engineering for Intercom's radio stations in Madison and Milwaukee. Basically a wrench. I go around and fix stuff. Had my hands in some telephone wiring yesterday, and then the other day I was doing photo auditing, working on a building expansion. I got my hands in everything. So I do have a lot of fun doing that. I'm also a contributing writer to Radio Guide magazine, all kinds of stuff.
You know, Chris, last week we missed talking about your phone auditing extravaganza. And I'd like to, before we get into our conversation with our special guest this week, I'd like to see if we can cover that. Would you be comfortable talking about that this week right away?
Sure. Yeah, it won't take long.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and introduce our special guest. You know, I try to get a guest on the show every couple of weeks or so, and we're really blessed to have this guy because a lot of folks in the broadcast engineering community look up to him. He is the executive director
of the Society of Broadcast Engineers, and it's John Poré. Hello, John. Welcome in.
Good evening, Kirk and Tom and Chris. Good to be here.
We're glad to have you. And just as by way of a quick introduction, John, you are not by trade an engineer. You are by trade an executive director. You understand how to run an organization.
Well, I hope so. That's been my career ever since college. In fact, I even went to college with the idea of learning how to run nonprofit organizations. So I've been doing it for a long time and pleased to have been with the SBE for almost now 20 years.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't realize it was that long. Well, glad to have you on board. I remember meeting you, I guess, for the first time in person. You came to an SBE meeting in Nashville, and we're very glad to have you at our chapter there. And so I run into you, I guess, every year or two at national events. You did a white paper at this NAB that we just finished up in April, and that white paper concerned the aging population of broadcast engineers, which is a kind of an interesting, scary, and not too hard to predict subject. So when we get into that, why don't you give us a little preview of what you're going to be telling us about this white paper?
Okay, well, it was an honor to be able to do that. You know, it's a technical conference, obviously, and the Broadcast Engineering Conference Committee kind of did a little departure for an hour and invited myself and Fred Baumgartner to present two papers that have to do with where are the broadcast engineers today, where are we going to be in the future, the backgrounds and so on, and what does this whole field look like down the road. So did a fair amount of evaluation of some statistics that we have available to us through the SBE's database. And we probably are going to reconfirm some things that probably a lot of you out there already know. But there may be some things in there that might surprise you as well.
Well, I want to be excited to get into the subject matter of your paper. You did a lot of research on this, and we're going to see, you know, the facts that you'll bring out and what conclusions that we might draw from those facts and analysis of those. So I'm excited to get into that in just a few minutes.
Okay.
All right, we're going to hit upon a subject here that we didn't quite have time to get to last week. Chris Tarr, you were involved in, I guess, what you call a telephone audit at your cluster of stations in Milwaukee. And, you know, I've heard of doing this, but I'm not exactly sure how you go about it. What's a telephone audit? What do you do? How do you go about it? And what was your end result?
Well, you know, a lot of radio stations, especially ones that have been around for a while and even in larger markets, have telephone lines and telephone services all over the building, all over the place. And with engineer turnover and staff turnover, things get added, things get removed, and you kind of lose track of what's there. Now, we did have an outside company come in and audit what we were paying and helped us find some, you know, some new contracts for some things and things like that. But we didn't really take a look at each individual line and service and determine, you know, do we need it? Is there something that, you know, we could be doing differently? Those sorts of things. And so as a result, you know, we had a little bit of savings a few years ago, and that was pretty much the end of it. But, since engineers typically don't pay the bills, the accounting department does, a lot of times we don't kind of see the feature creep, as I like to call it, with these lines. And all of a sudden you look back and you all realize that you're paying a whole lot more money now than you were maybe 2, 3, 4 years ago, and you want to find out why. So the job I had was I took a set of bills from the same month in the past 3 years. So 2012, 2011, 2010, same month, all the bills, and compared them bill for bill. And not only did that, but looked at each service and determined what exactly that service was for. And by doing all of that, I can see patterns. I can see where expenses went up maybe. I can see, you know, is there, a feature that we need or don't need or that we could change. And the bottom line is I managed to put together over $1,500 a month in savings for our company.
What?
I mean, it's amazing what you'll find. Here's some of the things that I found. For example, at our transmitter sites, I had ISDN lines put in as a backup path for audio in case for some reason we had to leave our studios. We had to broadcast live from somewhere else in an emergency, something like that. So we had these ISDN lines parked, which several years ago, I mean, that was really the technology you needed to do to have those. Well, those are $250 a month per line.
Oh,
so I started looking at that. Yeah, yeah. And the technology has changed enough where really you can use a $60 DSL line in a barracks box and accomplish the same thing in an emergency. So,
sure, yeah,
you know, three of those lines, that's, you know, several hundred dollars right there. That's $500, almost $600 in savings just right there by removing the unnecessary ISDN lines and putting in DSL. Instead of paying $250 a month, you're paying $60. And really, it's not even that, because it's, you know, we attach it to phone lines that we already have. So it's really more like $30 a site extra as opposed to $250. And we accomplish the same thing. Another thing we found was we had a dry alarm pair. Well, you know, we really didn't need that. You know, common current alarm systems all use dial-out now for alarm systems. Ours was already set up to do that. We just didn't use that feature. So we turn that feature on, attach it to a POTS line that we already had through our PRI, which is a lot cheaper, and disconnected the dry pair that really was costing us a lot of money and was pretty unnecessary. Another issue we found, we have a T1 circuit that feeds one of our transmitter sites. Well, about a year ago, went out of contract. Nobody paid attention to it. That was costing us several hundred dollars a month in that fee, because we go from the contract rate to the tariff rate.
So the rate just, well, you still need the T1 line, but the rate went up,
sure,
because it went out of its contract. You're on a month-to-month basis at that point.
We went from a contract to a month-to-month. That's a line we're not going to get rid of. We've had it for years and years, and we'll have it for years and years to come. So, you know, it's a no-brainer to go, yeah, give me your best rate for a three-year contract or whatever. We'll resign that, bring that rate down. So, you know, we also found we had one phone line that had a bunch of unnecessary services. They added them all on when we ordered the line. There was, you know, call forwarding, three-way calling, all these things that we were paying for that we never use on a line like that. Again, I mean, it's those little things that add up, you know, $25 here, $10 there. In some cases with the ISDN line, several hundred dollars. So it just kind of paid to have, you know, somebody other than the finance side of it really go through these bills and take a look at what we're using. And, you know, oftentimes as engineers we'll do that, but we don't do it every year. And so there are things like those ISDN lines where a couple of years ago when I saw those come up, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That would be the way we would get programming to the sites if we needed to. Well, fast forward a couple of years, we really don't need ISDN to do that anymore. You know, DSL in this situation works just fine. So, you know, it kind of pays. And again, I was talking about this on Facebook yesterday or today. It's nice that, you know, in this situation where I typically cost the company money because I'm fixing things and spending money on parts, I can actually save them some significant money just by taking some time. It took me about 2 days of pouring through bills. I had, you know, stacks of bills as high because, of course, with the phone company, you don't just have one bill with everything on it. You have 800 different bills that you have to look at. But it was a good situation and again a great way in terms of the station management to put engineering people in a positive light, because, you know, they look at these things and these outside companies look at these things and they don't really understand what it is that we're using or why we need them. They just look at, you know, the rates that we're paying, and, you know, so they just pay the bills. They don't really think about what it is or what it's for. And, you know, this is an opportunity for me to go through and go, hey, you know, we really don't need this, or there's a better way we can do that, or, you know, like the alarm lines and things like that. So I was very pleased that I was able to do that. And I think that if you're an engineer at a station, you probably should do that, you know, if you haven't yet, every year or two, just go through the bills, take one bill from this year, one bill from last year, and see what the pattern is. And, you know, there's a good chance that you may be paying more than you need to. And it may even be like, you know, in one situation with one of our clusters, okay, I only found about $125, but that's $125 a month we're not paying. And it was, you know, real easy things. That one just had a couple of call forwarding additions on there that it took off. So, you know, it's just one of those situations where a trained eye and somebody who knows what they're looking at can say, hey, you know, we're probably overpaying here.
Chris, do you worry, and Tom can ring on this too, do you guys worry that, okay, if you ask the phone company to make a change, that they're going to screw something up? Like you say, hey, I don't need call forwarding on this line or on this hunt group. I don't need that as an option. We're never going to use it. And I don't need a voicemail or anything on these. I just need them to ring on this hunt group. And the next thing you know, they've taken away or screwed up all your request lines or your call and talk show lines. Does that ever prevent you from making a change?
No, I think it depends. You know, we do have, you know, a feature or two where, you know, on a critical line, we're all, you know, really consider, is it worth the risk versus the reward? But most of the time it's worth the reward. And generally, you know, we've had good luck with the phone company, knock on wood, with those sorts of things. And you know, really what we're talking about are things that are, you know, POTS lines, for example, for POTS codecs, you know, those sorts of things. I think if it were a critical line, I'd be a little more cautious. But generally, you know, if you're just changing features and you're not changing anything about the line, for example, types of lines or the numbers or anything like that, it's a pretty simple process. And I really haven't had any, so far, any bad experiences doing that.
Got you. Tom, how about you in New York? You ever make a change and have the line go away or be totally messed up?
Oh, you've met our phone company. Oh, no, that happens. That happens every so often, and you know, I mean, accidents do happen when they're making changes in these things. Like Chris says, if you're asking for a simple change, yeah, it's not really a big deal. You know, take voicemail off or whatever. But if you're actually changing the structure of the line and you need it to do maybe something a little bit different, you're looking to change something major, that's when things get screwed up, and that's when you cross your fingers and hope they don't pull the line by accident, or all of a sudden you try to make a phone call and they've pulled your long distance pick, or it just won't translate what you're putting in properly. That's called a translation error. And next thing you know, you're on the phone for an hour and a half. We usually give them 24 hours to repair something like that, and then we let our morning man go wild on the air. Not a problem.
That's right. You do have that 50-kilowatt microphone. And, Chris Starr, you got several you know, outlets there, too, that are of quite a bit of power. I guess that's an advantage for broadcasters.
You know, you've got that. And generally, you know, you think about the backup plan if something does go wrong in those situations. And, you know, we really haven't had an issue where it's brought us to our knees. Okay, maybe, you know, we've had once or twice where – you know, one of the request lines isn't working that particular hour or two. But, you know, I have pretty good contacts at the phone company to where if something goes really, really south quickly, I can get somebody on it fairly quick. But, you know, in these situations, it's almost always worth the money because, you know, with the phone company, there are no $2 or $3 additions. It's $25, $30. And, you know, on the surface, one of those doesn't look like much. But when you're talking about like what I just did, where you've got hundreds of lines, you know, all it takes is five lines with a $25 or $30 surcharge for some service, and you're starting to talk about some real money there. And especially when you look at it over the course of a year, you know, $1,500 a month—that's a lot of money.
Yep, sure is. Well, listen, thanks for that education on phone company audits. Probably a good idea, as you said, to do that every year or two, maybe twice a year if you can. And so the engineer is aware of what's being spent with an eye toward, do we need that line? Do we need that line? And sometimes I guess it's hard to find. It's hard to notice on a bill something that they're charging you for that you really don't need. So that's why it's good to take a look at it. Hey, Chris, thanks for being patient and updating us with that we didn't get to last week. Let's go ahead and bring in our special guest, John Poire. Hey, John, how are you?
I'm fine. Doing well?
Good deal. Thanks for being patient, and
sure.
I'd like to jump right into your subject matter after we make sure that you're properly introduced. Again, you are the executive director of the Society of Broadcast Engineers, an organization that how many percentage wise broadcast engineers, as far as you know, are members of the SBE?
Well, SBE has about 5,500 members, and. Mm-hmm. It's hard to tell, really, what percentage we have overall because there's so many different positions that are identified in a technical way in broadcast stations. But we probably have about 75% of the radio and television engineers that are currently working today.
Gotcha. Yeah, I thought it was probably half or better, and it sounds like it is. Well, being the head of an organization like this, now as the executive director, you—I take it—you're not an elected official with SBE. You are paid by the organization to run the organization. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. We're governed by an elected board of directors. We have our elected president, which is Ralph Hogan, right now, And Ralph is in his first term. Ralph's, of course, a radio engineer at KJZZ in the Phoenix market. And we have 17 members on our board of directors, all volunteers. And so I report to them and on a day-to-day basis to our president. And then they entrusted me to manage our day-to-day operations. And we have our headquarters staff in Indianapolis, where we have six full-time and one part-time individual. And hopefully get a lot done, especially for our size.
So the NAB, I take it, came to you and said, hey, we'd like some kind of presentation at this NAB show. What happened there? How did you end up deciding what to talk about?
Well, the SBE has been involved with the NAB for many years with the spring show in Las Vegas, and actually for about the last 16 years has been the co-presenter of the Broadcast Engineering Conference with the NAB. And so we've been participating in that process, which includes some meetings of the Engineering Conference Committee in the fall each year. And so last fall, at a meeting that I was attending, along with our Fred Baumgartner, the chairman of our NS Educational Foundation educational programs, the committee got into a conversation about where are the engineers going to come from in the future and kind of side issues as well on that. And decided, hey, you know, it's a departure from what we normally do with a technical conference, but why don't we see if we can get a couple of papers about this subject? And they called it management of engineering in difficult times, I think, or something like that. And it was only 1 hour, so it was only two papers long. And I did the first one, and Fred did the second one, and both related to this topic. So mine was called The Shortage of Broadcast Engineers. Is there, or do we just need to know where to look? And my goal out of that was trying to answer two questions, which was, where do I find a broadcast engineer these days? And do I hire someone with knowledge of RF, the traditional broadcast engineer, or IT, or both?
All right. So there's the premise. How did you do your research? And of course, we'll come to the conclusions as we get through this. But where did you begin to research this paper about where, you know, is there a short of engineers, or do we just not know where to look?
Right. Well, I wanted to start with really to try and set a basis of where we are today as far as stations. Are there fewer or more, and the number of engineers and technicians? And it's a very broad category of employment if you talk to the federal government. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, I went there first and found that back in 1999, they counted over 25,000 people who worked in the technical side of broadcasting. But by 2001, 2008, about 9 or 10 years later, that had dropped by about 3,000 to just over 22,000. And again, that takes in all kinds of categories that we might not consider as traditional engineering positions. In a TV station, it might be camera people. It may be some production folks and that sort of thing. Unfortunately, they don't break it down into a more of a technical and engineering side that we'd like to see. But another figure that they reported was the number of what they call broadcasting establishments. And again, we're talking both radio and television, that in 2001, there were 10,287 of those. And by 2001, that had dropped to 9,737, so a 5% decline in the number of broadcasting establishment stations. So right there, you can draw, I think, a conclusion pretty logically that there were fewer positions in broadcasting and, of course, fewer positions in engineering itself due to those two sets of statistics. But then we went from there, and I took a look at some statistics based on the database that we have at the Society of Broadcast Engineers that we keep of our members. Not only the current members, but new members coming in during 2011. Found some interesting things. I took a look, and if we have that first chart, I think, Burke, from the paper, if that's available, that'll give a good description, I think, of one of the statistics that we found.
Oh, Burke,
pull that up.
That?
But,
okay. Page two, I think. Yeah,
there you are. Right, page two, And if I don't know if the whole thing is visible there, but I'll explain it. Basically, the three tallest bars on that bar chart, the green, the purple, and the blue, are the ones really to look at. The green one represents the members. And this is, of course, just looking at members of the Society of Broadcast Engineers. And we're gonna make the assumption that we will represent the industry as a whole because, frankly, we do have a large number of them. So if you extrapolate these figures over the entire broadcast engineering community. But that green bar represents the members who in 2001 were between the ages of 36 and 45 years old, and it was just a little under 27% of our total. The next bar to the right, the purple bar, represents the 46 to 55-year-old category, and that is just over 36% of our total membership. And then the next one to the right, the blue bar, represents the 56 to 65-year-old members, and that's just over 16%. So that's what it looked like in 2001. Now, if we take a look at the next chart, Bert, we jump to 2011, 10 years later, and we're going to see a pretty dramatic change. And that those same three bars, we got the green, the purple, and the blue here in the middle of the chart. The green has dropped to 14%. Now, that was the 36 to 45-year-old group. So just about half of what it was 10 years before. And the purple bar is about the same. It's 32%, just a little bit less than it was 10 years before. But the big the blue bar has jumped to more than double what it was in 2001. It's just over 33%. So we've seen a shift, essentially, from going to the right of our membership and essentially the broadcast engineering community, going from that 46 to 55-year-old range up to 56 to 65. If you combine those two together, that's 65% of the broadcast engineering community somewhere between the ages of 46 and 65 years old. So that probably doesn't surprise many folks in the broadcasting business because they look around and that's what they see. I'll bring up in a little bit, some other statistics that may be surprising, I think. Taking a look, let me back up. Those statistics I just quoted were working broadcast engineers. That did not include those in our membership that are retired and what we call life members. Now, one statistic that does include all of our membership is just the average age. And in that same 10-year period, we found that the average age has gone from just under 50 years old to about 54 years old. So it's jumped 4 years. In that 10-year span.
Okay. All right. So that statistic, doesn't at all seem surprising to me. I guess I would, if you go to a typical SBE meeting. I'm 50 now, and except for maybe four people, I'm probably the youngest at our Nashville SBE meetings. Hope I'm not stepping on any toes here. I believe I'm probably the fourth or fifth youngest out of maybe 20, 25 people that show up on a regular basis. And whenever I go to SBE meetings, I'm talking to usually a bunch of guys with gray hair.
And you'll see a lot of that around the country, and it will vary from chapter to chapter. SBE has 114 chapters around the country, and they're all a little bit different. And some are dominated radio, some are dominated with TV folks, some have a nice blend of everybody that comes. And from an age standpoint, in a lot of them, you will see a lot of the older folks. And I think that's not just true for our association. I think you'd probably see that in many associations that meet, because typically those in their 20s and 30s and even into their early 40s, in some cases, they're not quite as tuned in to their professional organization at that point in their career, especially the younger ones. They probably also have families with young children and other things that will keep them at home if the chapter meeting's at night. Or they may not be up the ladder yet far enough in their organization that if it's a lunch meeting during the day, that they can get away. So it does skew that way. One of the interesting things I found, Kirk, in doing the look at our statistics is that, because I always hear from people, oh, you know, we're just not seeing young people enter the business anymore. And, you know, our statistics would kind of refute that. We found that in 2011, we had 547 new members join the SBE last year. And out of that, 25%, 25% were 30 years old or younger.
Wow.
It was surprising. And I looked at about half of the years in the decade leading up to 2011, and that was very consistent. So we're getting younger people, and also the demographic of those younger people typically is that they're coming with a combination of an IT and an engineering or electronics background through some formal education. And in some cases, some radio or TV station background, perhaps as a high school or college student as well. So there are young people coming in, and but there's not as many coming in as there are leaving out the other end of the age spectrum.
What's this this graph that Burke just threw up a graph here with two line charts?
Yeah, that's another depiction of what I was talking about with the bar charts, where basically the red line represents the membership in 2001. And I don't know if it's large enough there for you to see, but you'll see the age categories along the bottom axis there. The blue line represents the membership in 2011. So basically it's a shift to the right, a shift to the older age categories.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, that statistic about folks under 30, you said 500 and some, was it 547 became members in, what was it? I'm sorry, was that 2010 or 2011?
2011.
Now, what about the number of people, do you have any statistics on people retiring from engineering or people leaving their membership ranks of the SBE? And it seems like you might well retire but maintain your membership in SBE. That seems like a likely scenario. But what can you tell about the top end or people leaving, whether they're at the top end of the age range or not?
Mm-hmm. Well, what we're finding is that people, first of all, there are, of course, many people that are still in the industry and working every day, and thousands of them, actually. But we are seeing people leave the industry due to retirements, due to workforce reductions that are due to economics in the last few years, due to deregulation. When it comes to, in the case of radio, when we saw the station buyouts and so on, and the large companies buy up stations and end up with clusters of 4, 5, 6, 7 stations in a market, we saw a reduction of radio engineers in that market. Although that also created, in many cases, some good, solid chief engineer or director of engineering positions in those markets, where those people have done quite well, and they've got a lot of responsibilities and sometimes not a lot of help. But they've become pretty comfortable in those positions, and that's actually served to create a shortage of broadcast engineers in some other markets that struggle. And a lot of times those are the smaller or mid-sized markets, maybe in more rural areas, because it's hard to attract the qualified broadcast engineer to pull away from that position they have now. And frankly, many of those just don't have the money or aren't offering the money to lure them away.
You know, one thing I've sure have noticed over the past probably 20 years is that in a lot of small markets, sometimes the station engineer was also the local TV repair guy. And I got to know several in several small towns. And some of them were great radio engineers and some of them weren't so good, but they kept the station on the air barely. And then when it really had a problem, the station owner might end up calling a contract engineer like me in. But we don't have TV repair guys anymore, at least not independents. We don't have people, you know, doing component level repair on television sets, at least not so much. You know, the local TV repair shop is very much a thing of the past in most places. So it seems like that local resource, which was somewhat common in rural America, has now gone away. And sure, we have computer repair shops. That's taken over a little bit. But these guys may or may not have skills that relate to, you know, fixing RF amp modules or even dealing with stereo audio and keeping it in phase. So I just think that that's just an observation. I didn't really but maybe you've got a comment on what I just said. And then Tom Ray has a question and comment, yeah, too.
Well, I think one of the things we've seen over the last 10 to 15 years is engineers leaving the stations for one reason or another. And opening their own contract engineering business. And we see that all over the country. It's 20 years ago, those were the guys that were, that was kind of a dirty word. If you're a contract engineer, you were threatening the people that worked at the stations. But the reality today is that's a fact of life. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of broadcast engineers that either work full-time or part-time to supplement their income from their station job by doing work on the side. And many of those are doing that on a full-time basis and are excellent professionals. They know what they're doing. They've got good training. Hopefully they're certified from the Society of Broadcast Engineers. We've seen just a growing trend that way and within our membership. And try to help and support that subgroup of our membership by helping to let people know that they're available. There's not a week that goes by that I don't get contacted by either an engineer or a station general manager saying, hey, I need some help with an engineering problem. I don't have anybody. You know, can you suggest anybody? And we send them to our website where we have a list of contract engineers around the country by state.
Well, do you find? Well, I've got a million questions. Tom Ray had a comment and question he wanted to ask. Tom, come on in. Tom engineers in the number one market in the U.S., the biggest market, New York City. But Tom, you also take care of some medium sized and smaller markets too.
I echo some of what John said. I mean, you go to the SBE. Well, like you said, Kirk, you go to the SBE meetings. You don't see the young people. And you know, what's really scary, I don't know about Chris Tarr, but when I got into the business, this is all I wanted to do. I wanted to get involved in broadcasting. And those people nowadays are few and far between. You don't find those people anymore. And I haven't quite figured out why. But in a way, I think maybe it's what draws me and keeps me going. Very bluntly, as a chief engineer, I'm a director of engineering, but as a chief engineer at a radio station, there's an awful lot you have to do. And, you know, sometimes the people at the stations don't quite understand what we do or why we do. And in a smaller market, you actually may have some tube equipment to service. So I need to be able to service something with tubes and service the latest microprocessor-based piece of equipment and understand how they work and sometimes integrate them. Sometimes the hours are long. I mean, let's face it, you can't take the radio station off the air at 2 in the afternoon to do some simple work. And as an example, I have to go in tomorrow night to change a networking switch out in actually our Axia system. It's got to get done and, I can't do it at 2 in the afternoon because it's going to take us off the air for about 2 or 3 minutes. You just can't do that, especially in New York City. It's bad enough doing it at 1 in the morning, which is why I'm going to do this. But, you know, you just can't do that. And sometimes I don't know if it's the work ethic of some of the kids coming out of school today or if it's just a general attitude or what the thing is, but they want the job. Some of them want the job where they go in at 9 and leave at 5, don't have to worry about it till, you know, tomorrow morning, or God forbid it's the weekend. They don't want to hear about it. They want to sit at their desk. They don't want to get dirty. I mean, I love walking through the swamp. I mean, let's be honest, getting back to other things where some people are getting out and such, well, because you need to know how to use tubes, and you know how have to work on something that's microprocessor based, up at the older end, maybe they, those guys don't want to deal with it because, yeah, let's face it, there's a lot to learn. There's a lot. You've constantly have to keep, you know, keep the wheels moving and do what you, you know, and keep up on top of everything. But, you know, the day's never boring. That's what I like about the job. The day is never boring. You don't know when you walk in the next morning what you're going to encounter. And that's usually what keeps me going and what I like about this business. And I get puzzled sometimes. I don't know. I don't know why people don't want to come into it. And, yeah, there's a lot of things that we could probably get into here and reasons. And this could be several shows actually on discussions of why people would want to get out of the business. But, you know, I mean, overall, beat some of the other things you could be doing. I've watched Dirty Jobs at Mike Rowe, and let me tell you, there's some stuff I wouldn't want to get involved with.
I'll tell you, Chris Starr,
you probably would be an advocate of Tom's assertion that there's never, you know, never 2 days alike and never a boring day as a broadcast engineer. If you're looking for something, a different challenge every day, yeah, a few of the same ones. But if you're looking for a job where you've got to learn about something new all the time, broadcast engineering is certainly it. Go ahead, Chris Starr. I probably took your thunder.
Well, no, I mean, I was going to say a lot about that and, you know, with ham radio and things. I love radio, and that's why I do what I do. However, I think one of the issues that we're facing today as broadcast engineers and why it's difficult to bring people in is I think, unfortunately, and this is not, it was more inevitable than really, I'm not passing judgment on large corporations or the people that run them, but, you know, we're no longer run by radio people. We're run by Wall Street, and these people don't understand a lot of times broadcast engineering and what its responsibilities and its value is. And so what happens is you've got people who don't really have a whole lot of value on what these people do. Because quite honestly, if you do your job well, it makes it look like you're not doing anything, you know, because everything's working. What do we need him for? Everything works just fine. Well, it's because they don't understand that because we're working hard, that's why it is. And so I think there's not a lot of effort to let people know that this job exists. And I think oftentimes, you know, in some facilities, you know, the engineers don't feel super appreciated. So they're not always the most open cheerleaders, I guess, for the industry. So I think, you know, some of it is self-inflicted in that, you know, I think at some point there needs to be a concerted effort to let the powers that be in Wall Street and the people running radio remember what we're here for and why we're so valuable to the business. I think that, you know, that'll help. But I think, too, there is, you know, there used to be training and there used to be schooling. There isn't any of that anymore. So if you are interested in it and you're in your early 20s, where do you go? What do you do? How do you get involved? You know, there's a lot of that kind of thing going on as well. So I think there's a couple of forces at play here. But, you know, everything that I'm seeing from John Perret really doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, we've been talking about that for years. I mean, I'm on the lower end of the scale. But, you know, of the age scale. But, you know, I go to meetings and I'm 42 and I'm usually one of the youngest ones in the room. So, you know, that I don't know that that's a problem yet, but I think it's going to be a crisis in a few years. I just don't think that everyone understands how bad this could be in about 10 years.
Yeah. You know, Chris, I think, and you kind of hit it on the head too with, you know, how when things are working, you just kind of sit there and people say, well, why do we need him? What's he doing? But back when I started in the business 35 years ago, and I'm 52, I started 35 years ago, we had turntables in the studios that had to be maintained. I had cart machines in the studios that had to be maintained. And we're talking taking the cart. We played music on cart. We had to take the cart machines out every week, align the heads, you know, check the pinch roller tension, the whole bit, just to make sure we didn't have a mistake on the air. We had tube transmitters that tended to like to drift a little bit. My transmitters at WOR, I mean, they're fully solid state. I rarely touch them. You know, I open the door, I look at it. Oh, by the way, it's got a Linux chip in it. It's starts with a computer. The only thing I've touched recently is the antenna system. And that was a little issue we had with wind a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, when things are, and yes, there's maintenance to do on computer systems, but it's not like pulling a cart machine apart. You're not constantly busy. Sometimes I'm sitting at my desk. I'm maintaining a computer in the master control room, sitting at my desk talking on the phone just because I can get into it. So it doesn't look like you're doing much, but there's a lot going on.
I'm going to we've got to pause for a moment here and hear from our sponsor. And when we come back from that, I'll bet you John Poré sees more than we do as engineers of young people being interested in the profession of broadcast engineering, because that's part of what he would be doing with SBE is matching up people's expressed interest with getting involved with broadcasting. And I want to ask John about that and also finish up telling his conclusions about his white paper. But first, let's hear from my friends and our sponsor, the folks at Omnia Audio. If you go to the internet, go to the website, Omnia, that's O-M-N-I-A, omniaaudio.com. I want to tell you about a couple of products that don't get a whole lot of play in us talking about them. One is Omnia AXE. Now, we gave away a number of licenses on Omnia AXE over the past few months. Omnia AXE is software that runs in a Windows environment. It runs as a service, so it's not an application that has to be up running. It's a service, so it's a lower level, kind of a kernel level service there. And it processes incoming audio, and then it encodes that audio in any one of several different formats like MP3 or AAC or HEAAC or HEAAC V2, different formats, and then sends it on out to your streaming service provider. So if you need a product that will encode audio and then and audio and process the audio appropriately for making a really good sounding stream, Omnia AXE can do this for you. And because it runs in a PC, which has a lot of horsepower available to it, Omnia AXE can actually do a lot of things. It can encode with just one license. You buy one license. It can encode in a number of different formats all simultaneously and then send out a number of different streams in different formats if that's what you need it to do. You can also just do straight audio processing with it if you want to, just to have audio come in and audio go back out. And your choices of audio in and out of the PC are just whatever the PC can do. In other words, you could use whatever sound card is built into the PC motherboard, or you can add an expensive sound card if you like. You can also do live wire, digital IP audio in and out of the PC. Your audio going in would be, uncompressed live wire. Your audio, you could get uncompressed live wire coming back out that's been processed. And of course, you have your lower bitrate audio, your streaming audio, also coming out of the Omnia AXE computer. So that's one product, Omnia AXE. There's a sort of a similar product called Omnia FXE. Now, Omnia FXE is a file-based audio processor. So if you're in the business of generating content, maybe you create shows or you take content in from other suppliers, and you need that content to be consistent in its audio level and maybe in the way it sounds as far as the lows versus the mids versus the highs. Omnia FXE is a file-based processor. You can take files and just drag and drop them into the GUI of Omnia FXE, or you can start the folder bot that's part of Omnia FXE and have that folder bot watch one or more folders. When a new file appears there, it'll grab that file, it will do audio processing on that file, and then will re-encode it at whatever bit rate and whatever of many different codecs that you want it to, and then place that file where you want it to be, maybe for playback later or for playback on demand by your listeners. So Omnia FXE can fix your problem of content coming from different producers or even from different entities make that content all similar in texture and in audio volume. So check out these two Windows-based products, Omnia AXE and Omnia FXE from Omnia Audio. Omnia, tell you what, man, these guys know a lot about processing for streaming. It's just processing for encoded audio, and they do a great job. All right. You're listening to This Week in Radio Tech or watching it. I'm Kirk Harnack, along with Tom Ray from the Hudson Valley of New York and Chris Tarr from Mukwonago, Wisconsin. We're talking with our special guest, John Poré, the executive director of the Society of Broadcast Engineers. Okay, John, let's get to some conclusions about your white paper. What can you conclude and what can we, maybe look forward to in terms of your conclusions? And where are young engineers coming from, and do we need them? Are we going to get enough of them?
Are the jobs coming or going away?
We certainly need them. And I think, you know, SBE and our board of directors many years ago, actually going back to the late 90s, recognized the looming shortage and the dearth of young people coming into the business, and actually started a youth membership category back in 1999 for high school kids interested in broadcast engineering. The reality, though, I think we found over the years, is that identifying who those people are, who those kids are, is pretty difficult. A lot of schools, as you know, have a radio and television, or at least radio program at their high school or a career center. And yet, most of the time, about 90% of the kids involved in that are not really interested in the technical side. They're more in the on-air production and that sort of thing. But we did what we could do to try and reach out to those kids to let them know about the SBE. And they, for just a very little amount of money, they could become a youth member. And then we would feed them information about what this industry is, try to tie them into the local chapter where they could meet some real working broadcast engineers and find out about the career. Now, the SBE has certified about a dozen colleges, 2 and 4 year schools around the country, who do have broadcast technical curriculum that leads to a degree of some sort, 2-year or 4-year degree. I don't know if you have that chart, but the list of those schools is on page 12, Burke, if you have that. And those schools, their curriculum is reviewed by our certification committee once every 5 years to ensure that what they're teaching is up to date with today's technology. But those schools are a ready source of graduates coming out into the business. Another source of young people, or at least skewing younger, is from the military. We have a good number of members that are active military around the world, U.S. military, that are in the AFRTS service. And we actually even have a chapter in Fort Meade, Maryland, where a lot of these folks come through and get deployed around the country. But members on ships and on bases and so on all around the world. And when they're done with their duty with the military, they want to come back into civilian life, and many of them get work in broadcast stations. So that's another good source. Another source that I mentioned in the paper is something that the NAB has done the last 2 or 3 years, which is have an engineering apprenticeship program where they have selected 10 people from around the country that are typically college seniors, although they may not be the traditional college senior age. They can be up to 30, 40 years old or more, based on their interests, and tie them into a 6-month, what they call apprenticeship, where they will attend the NAB show in the spring. That kind of kicks it off, where they can be exposed to the engineering sessions, the trade show itself, and meet some of the folks involved in the industry. But then they place them in a internship for the summer with a broadcast station in a technical role. They'll do some projects together. The NAB pulls them back together towards the end of the summer. They have the opportunity to earn the certified broadcast technician certification from the SBE at the end of their internship. But then there are a small number, but there's 10 people that are ready to enter into the business. But the conclusions from the paper, Kirk, are several, I think. And one is that, first of all, of course, there's fewer engineers today than there was 10 years ago. They are older than they were. We have fewer coming in now than we have leaving. And so that all those factors combine to suggest that, as Chris alluded to a little while ago, that we're going to have a serious problem here in 5 to 10 years, maybe 5 years, and a talent gap, if you will, in some areas. For instance, in some of the RF skills and knowledge, you know, whether it's AM or FM, doesn't matter either way, or from the IT side, depending on a market. A lot of the markets, smaller markets, more rural markets, have a hard time finding those skill sets in people. Ironically, though, there would appear to be plenty of jobs available. in the paper, I refer to one day last January, this year in January, that I took a look at the SBE Jobs Online listing. That's our free listing of radio and television jobs around the country. And at that time, there were 59 jobs posted. And I have to tell you, only 12 of those jobs were in radio. The rest were, most of them were in television. A couple of them were with manufacturers. But it's very skewed, and not a lot of them in radio. We took a look today in preparation for tonight's program, and we have 101 jobs now posted on the job line. And these don't just stay on forever. They last for 60 days, and they're automatically purged unless the employer wants to repeat them again. Yeah. And they can post their jobs on our service for free. And they're available for our members to see. But of 101 jobs that are on there today, 17 of them are in radio, 73 are in television, and 11 others are in various other related kinds of fields. You know, that would suggest that there's a shortage today, at least in some areas, as we go forth. And, you know, technology is going to drive this. The economy is going to drive this as we go forward. I think the key thing that engineers today and those just coming into business, especially that want to make this their career for another 20 or 30 or 40 years, is that they have to stay up with technology. And that means continuing education, whether it be through manufacturer schools, some of which, you know, there's not as many as there used to be, but some of them which still exist, certainly through the programming that we have through the society, and we've ramped that up tremendously in the last 3 years, where we provide webinars on every month. In fact, we have three this month alone on various topics. We have online courses that are a little bit more in depth. We have a broadcast engineer management training program, an in-depth 3-day course that'll be in Atlanta this summer. And we have the Ennis workshops that we have done for many years that are traditional in-person seminars done around the country. We have one coming up in El Paso, Texas next week. And in mid-June, we'll be in Cleveland, Ohio. And this fall, we have one in Orlando. But to take advantage of those opportunities to stay up on the technology, look ahead, and don't allow yourself to be comfortable, I think, to just stay with what you know. You know, Tom, Chris, excellent examples of people who are staying up with technology you know, have careers that are you know, really great and good examples for young engineers to follow.
I'm looking at some of the job listings.
John, now Chris and I have to pay you.
You know, I'm looking at some of these job listings on the SBE.org website, there are 100 of them here. But, you know, some of these things, okay, sounds like a lot of work, and you've got to learn a lot. There's a lot to know to be a broadcast engineer, anything from, hey, supporting computer networks and related systems to departmental budgets to understanding and performing HVAC level 1 maintenance. Here, look at this. Operate a snowmobile or snowcat. Drive a vehicle with a trailer up to 10,000 pounds. Drive 4x4. Listen to this. Actually, I love this. Drive a 4x4 vehicle on unimproved mountain roads in all weather conditions. Yeah, count me in. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why we have a shortage of engineers. There, if you are a go-get-em person, you're interested in all the tech that we have nowadays, both legacy tech and today's modern tech, and you love doing stuff like driving a 4x4 vehicle up a mountain in bad weather conditions, which I would just be all about. Of course, I did that for years as a contract engineer. Man, there's job listings on the SBE.org website that may be just for you. I'm sorry, I interrupted. Tom or Chris, we're really out of time. Any last comments or questions for John Poiret?
No, I mean, I agree with everything you guys have said. And just to really quickly touch on what John said, take the opportunity if you're in this business or wanting into this business with the continuing education, especially with the SBE and also your local broadcast association. For example, here in Wisconsin, we have a great fall conference for engineering. SBE puts on fantastic programs, webinars, and things like that. And their certification program, as part of renewal for your certification, you have to participate in continuing education. And those people who are doing those things now are setting themselves up in 5 years, 10 years, when the job market gets you know, there's a lot of openings. You're going to set yourself up to be pretty successful, because there's going to be a lot less people available than there are positions. And the ones that do exceptionally well with continuing education and those things, those sorts of things, are going to be the ones that are really in high demand and can command, you know, the salaries and the staff and the things that you're going to need to really be successful in your career. So I strongly recommend, if you haven't joined SBE, join SBE. It's a fantastic investment in your career and in your education, and continue to learn and learn and learn and learn.
And, you know, the nice thing about SBE is, especially if you look up your local chapter, you don't have to be a member to go to the meetings. Our meetings are open to everybody and anybody. I mean, we've had a couple of members of SBE 15 in New York show up. They were just curious. They were listeners. And they showed up at the meetings. And you know, the interesting thing about broadcast engineers is, you know, there are some groups of people who an outsider like that would show up. They'd get laughed out of the room. We don't do that. We take them in. We talk to them. We let them ask their questions. We answer them. So, you know, look up your local SBE chapter. Join SBE. Take advantage of the educational opportunities, because the SBE meetings aren't necessarily sales pitches. And some people think, you know, sometimes they are, and sometimes they are. But for the most part, they're educational opportunities. John mentioned the NS workshops. We've done a couple in New York City. We've had a couple in Hartford with the Connecticut Broadcasters Association. They are excellent. I mean, they're not intended to be a be-all, end-all, but they will bring you up to date on many new technologies and show you things that are up and coming, and you get to meet a lot of people and ask questions and do some learning. So there's a lot of networking that goes on. And I'd even go as far to say, you know, if you're really interested in the business or you're interested in what we do, call a local station. Find out who the engineering person is. Maybe they've got somebody. Maybe they've got a contract engineer. They can put you in touch with that person and ask if the guy has some time maybe to answer some questions. I mean, I do this in New York all the time. People will call. They'll be interested. I take them to the transmitter. They'll come into the studio. Sometimes, you know, management kind of looks at you cross-eyed, and it's like, you know, many years ago, before consolidation, there used to be a farm team. There used to be smaller stations that all had an engineer. Part of that was required by the commission, but they, you know, it's not required so much anymore. But there was a farm team, kind of like in baseball. You had the A, the double A, the triple A. You made it to the majors. We tend not to have that anymore. So you need to reach out. You need to talk to people. You'll find that we're happy to answer questions. We're happy to show you around, you know, and maybe you'll hit it on a good day where there might be something you could do to get your foot in the door. And that's how you really start out and get a job in the broadcasting field, is to do it that way sometimes. And you know, make a friend with the local guy. You know, get interested in things like amateur radio, because a lot of us have learned that way as well. You'll have a lot of fun, and you'll meet some very nice people, and you'll see you know, some of the smoke and mirrors behind the scenes, which in some cases blows your mind.
All right, Tom, Chris, thank you for being with us. And John Poré, thank you for joining us for This Week in Radio Tech. I certainly appreciate your advice and your research into, you know, the aging population of broadcast engineers, and, you know, where new ones are going to come from and what's available out there. John, if folks want to get in touch with you or SBE, where would they go?
Well, they can reach me at our website, sbe.org. And also, we have a blog at blog.sbe.org and Twitter and LinkedIn. We're in all of those. And Facebook as well. You can like us on Facebook if you'd like. So we'd be happy to hear from you. And if you have any questions about membership or our chapters or education certification, please let us know. We'll answer those for you.
All right. And if you're looking for a job right now, you can go to the SBE website, sbe.org, and look at their online job posting. So lots of other items there, test certifications and test prep and lots of industry news. Good resource. John, thank you for your efforts in moving SBE along and keeping the engineering community together and trying to make it better. Appreciate you very much.
Thank you, Kirk. I'm glad to be here tonight.
All right. Our show, This Week in Radio Tech, has been brought to you by Omnia Audio and the Omnia AXE and FXE software audio processors. Check them out on the web at omniaaudio.com. And we're going to see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Our guest next week is going to be someone from ERI, Electronics Research Incorporated, talking about this great technology for mixing at high level HD transmitters and FM transmitters without losing a whole bunch of power like we used to do. So I've been looking forward to either Bill Harland or Ron Solomon or somebody like that from ERI being on our show next week. We're going to see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.